I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Here are some sobering statistics. Every day, tens of thousands of Americans turn 65. In 20 years, 11.5 million Americans will be over 85. Most elders do not want to go to nursing homes and would prefer to age in place, maybe even die in place. More than 40 million Americans are caring for an elder family member, half of them dealing with the needs of their parents and their kids. That's the so-called sandwich generation. And the people often hired to provide care for elders in their homes are paid less than a living wage. Age, often with no benefits. Our guest, Ai-Jen Poo, has some ideas about how to provide affordable, high-quality care for senior citizens while ensuring that their home care providers are treated like professionals. Her book is The Age of Dignity, Preparing for the Elder Boom in a Changing America. She is director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance, co-director of Caring Across Generations, and in 2014, she was awarded a MacArthur Fellowship to support her efforts to improve the working conditions and labor standards for domestics or private household workers. She joins us from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. And Ai-Jen Poo, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me, Marty. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you here. Are we prepared as a country, as families, as individuals for the elder boom that's already taking place?
We are not prepared. The elder boom is a demographic shift and phenomenon that's going to change the way we live and work and play in this country, and we have not adequately prepared. I know in my family, we didn't have a plan, and that had a disastrous impact in terms of my grandfather, who was forced to live in a nursing home for the last 3 months of his life against his wishes. And so I think that it's time. It's time. We can't afford not to have a plan at this point.
Do you think the way baby boomers, and I have to admit, I am a baby boomer, so in certain ways I am talking about myself here, but the baby boomers, because of just the sheer number of them, I mean, they changed adolescence in many ways, parenthood, middle age. Do you think they are also changing what it means to be an older person?
Absolutely. I think that is one of the main reasons why I'm as optimistic as I am and why my book is so hopeful. If ever there was going to be a generation to change the way we think and feel about aging in this country, it is going to be the generation who brought us rock and roll.
So I'm glad you feel that way.
I have a lot of faith, absolutely.
But we also hear that people saving for their retirement, whether Social Security or putting money aside, and I guess ready to retire, people do not have the money largely that they're going to need as they live into older age.
That's right. The economic pressure on working families today is such that there's very little room. And it is an all hands on deck situation where individuals are going to have to plan and save. Families are going to have to plan and save. And frankly, this country is going to have to prioritize the family caregiving needs of working families in particular in a way that it hasn't in the past. A lot of people think that Medicare covers long-term care comprehensively, and it just doesn't. And so if you're very, very poor, you could be eligible for Medicaid. And if you're wealthy, you might be able to support long-term care insurance, but even that is limited in what it covers when you need it. And so we actually need a whole new approach to caregiving, and I think that that's where the opportunity lies. We have a patchwork system at best, really no system at all at worst. A lot of people say we have nothing in place to really support the vast majority of Americans in terms of the care that they need. And so here's the opportunity to take a long-standing challenge in terms of families being able to afford the care that they need, the workforce that we count on to care for us actually being able to turn these jobs into good jobs for the future that you can really support your family on. This is the win-win opportunity as we think about the future and preparing for the elder boom.
Well, let's talk about some of those workers whose job it is to care for aging individuals. And you had mentioned in your book, you write in your book about a woman named Mrs. Sun who took care of your grandfather, and the kind of dedication that she had for his care, pretty extraordinary. But I know from others who have had care workers working with their families, many of them are pretty extraordinary as well in terms of their dedication for this really difficult kind of work.
Yes, many of us probably know somebody who does caregiving as a profession, and you know that it's you're a nutritionist, you're a nurse, you're a cook, you're so many things at once, and it takes enormous amount of skill, dedication, hard work, focus. I mean, these jobs are really skilled and difficult jobs that this professional workforce does with a tremendous amount of care and commitment. And for this hard work and dedication to our families, the average median income for a home care worker in this country is $13,000 per year.
Wow.
And I don't know a single city or town in this country for in which you could survive and support your family on that income. And so we've got a really dangerous contradiction here where the people that we count on to care for our families cannot care for their own.
And if you're talking about $13,000 a year, what is that per hour? Do you know?
You know, it really ranges. I mean, it's some people work 24-hour shifts for 4 days a week or for 3 days a week. And so the hours are, and many work live-in, and so the hours are hard to count. But I know many caregivers work for an average of $9 an hour or $10 an hour. In many places, home care workers are still excluded from minimum wage and overtime protections. And that is something we've been working on for many, many years now and are close to addressing. And we need states and families to start preparing for that as well.
Are these kind of off the books jobs, or are we talking about people hired through a professional agency?
We're mostly talking about people who are hired through agencies and many who work through publicly funded programs like Medicaid. And essentially, families are paying into the system and our public dollars are paying into the system. And what's coming out on the other end is extraordinarily low wages. So there's something very broken in the system. Mm-hmm. And we now have an opportunity, because the system is actually inefficient as it stands, to really transform that. One of the big problems with the system is it's biased towards nursing home care. And we know now that 90% of Americans actually prefer to age in place, as you mentioned earlier, and stay in their homes, connected to their families and communities. And so rather than continue to invest in a very broken nursing home system, we have to not only improve the way that nursing home care is delivered, but create many, many more options for people to receive the care that they need in their homes and in their communities.
You know, it reminds me of the problem with good quality child care, which is that it costs a lot of money. And if you're a working person and you're not making a lot of money, a lot of your income is going in to pay for child care. Is it similar when we're talking about older folks?
It is similar, and it goes to a root issue here, which is that our economy in this country, and it's different in other countries. Many countries in Europe have subsidies and other supports when it comes to family care. We here in the United States have never fully acknowledged the work and time it takes to raise families, children, or supporting our elders as they age. And families are really left on their own to struggle and to support their aging loved ones or their children in the care that they need. And it's kind of an impossible situation, especially for the 40 million plus who are struggling with both right. child care and elder care. And so I think what we need is a rethinking, because at the end of the day, we are already paying a tremendous amount for this care. We're just doing it in incredibly inefficient ways that are a real struggle and a bit of a free-for-all, where some people are, you know, getting insurance, some people are hiring under the table, and there's no systems or real protections for anyone involved or support, really.
Are we also talking in many ways about an invisible workforce, and that makes it, if it's invisible, then you can ignore it?
That's right. I think that the workforce that works in our homes is in many ways by definition somewhat invisible. You could go into any neighborhood or any apartment building and not know which apartments or which homes are actually somebody's workplace. And that is part of the challenge of ensuring that these jobs are good jobs, which is why it's so important that we go the extra mile to really be intentional about how we do that.
But let's say we want to pay home care workers $15 an hour, something like that. I'm not sure exactly what that is. It's probably, you know, $40,000 a year. But if a family has to pay for this, you know, where do they get the money in order to provide a professional salary for someone who's working to take care of a family member?
Right. Well, here's the thing is that families are already paying for this care. So the average nursing home stay, private room in a nursing home costs over $87,000 per year. Now, that's unimaginable for the 27 million of us who will be needing some form of care or assistance by the year 2050. On top of that, our Medicaid programs reimburse agencies at rates of over $20 per hour for home care. And on top of the low wages that workers are, so on the other end of the reimbursements, workers are earning very low wages, and the low wages are forcing many to rely on public assistance just to put food on the table. And so there are lots of ways that we're already paying for this care in inefficient and very, very costly ways, both privately as individual households and through public funding mechanisms. And so I would say that we need to strengthen how we think about our public funding and update it for the 21st century, as well as think about how we are both saving and reorganizing our services and our care to better support home and community-based care, because the institutional model is very expensive.
Well, we're almost up on a break here. It sounds like you're saying is that if elders want to stay in their homes rather than going to a nursing home, that's possible, and it's also possible to ensure that the people providing care for them have a living wage. We can do both, I hear you saying.
We can do both, and it's actually much more cost-effective.
Well, let's take a short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Our guest is Ai-Jen Poo, and she is the director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance, also co-director of Caring Across Generations. Last year in 2014, she was awarded a MacArthur Fellowship, also known as a Genius Award. It was in support of her efforts to improve working conditions and labor standards for domestic and private household workers. And she's also the author of a new book called The Age of Dignity, Preparing for the Elder Boom in a Changing America. And she says that we can, in a sense, do both, which is to provide quality care for elders and make sure that the people caring for them are paid a good salary. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Ai-Jen Poo about her new book called The Age of Dignity, Preparing for the Elder Boom in a Changing America. And I know, Ai-Jen, you are very positive about what we can do about addressing some of these problems, but I just want to ask whether you think part of the problem is that we're talking about workers who are probably largely female, and older Americans were probably largely female as well. Is this a female issue that we're talking about?
You know, women really are on the front lines of this age wave in every dimension. When we think about our life expectancy, women actually live longer on average than men. And then in terms of family caregivers, about 73% of all family caregiving work is done by women in families. And in terms of the professional caregiving workforce, over 90% of the professional caregiving workforce is women. And so absolutely, this is an issue that disproportionately impacts women, which is why it's so important that women are a large part of shaping the solutions. and why we have a holistic approach that is inclusive of the perspectives and experiences of women on every side of this equation.
We have email from Bobby. She says, my mother died in 2002 when we went through an agency for caregivers. We paid the agency $21 an hour. The woman who came got $8.50 an hour. She had been with them for 7 years. They were paying a lot of money for this care. The woman who was actually providing the care making a little more than minimum wage.
That's right. And that's very, very common. And as a result of that, in some states, they have caps on the percentage that agencies can take in overhead of either the fees that families are charged or the reimbursements from public funds. And I think that that's actually very important because the tendency will be to squeeze as much as possible out of the fees that families give. And we need to make sure that this workforce is stable and secure and can support their families and that these wages are actually sustainable.
So how do you suggest we address these intersecting problems then?
Well, I think we need public policy solutions as well as nonprofit, and every family actually has to participate in this as well. On the public policy front, there are sort of three core principles that we believe need to be at the heart of any viable solution. One is affordability and accessibility of quality care for families. The second is maximum choice, the choice to age at home, in the community, or in a nursing home receiving quality care. There's such a range of needs and situations that families are experiencing around this country, and choice is very key. And the third is quality jobs for the workforce. We are going to need a stable, strong professional workforce to support the millions of family caregivers out there. We are going to need a national care force that is not only strong, but continues to grow into the future, millions more in this workforce. And in fact, home care is the fastest growing occupation in the nation already because of the rising demand for this work. So those three elements have to be at the center of any public policy solution, and there are ways of making incremental steps towards that vision that are possible today.
Well, and I know having gone through this and having had friends who have gone through this as well, on the one hand, wanting to keep one's parents at home, but also worried that they're not going to be safe or that they're going to do something that's going to hurt themselves, or knowing if there's a snowstorm, perhaps the care worker is going to be able to get there. There are a lot of logistics that go into ensuring that someone is going to, you know, age in place and be safe in place.
There's so many logistics, and it's really challenging for families that are living far apart. A significant number of family caregivers are managing the care of their parents and other relatives from long distances. And that makes the role of the professional caregiver even more important. And potentially here, there's a role for technology as well in terms of facilitating good communication and coordination between families, seniors, the professional caregivers, and healthcare professionals. There's a lot that can be done to really upgrade how we think about care. And it's about really making this visible and our families proactively preparing for these changing needs in such a way that allows us to tap into some of these resources.
Years ago, I remember interviewing Maggie Kuhn, who was the founder of the Gray Panther. She lived here in Philadelphia. She was just an extraordinary woman, I have to say. Just,
yes.
You know, about a little bird, really. She was just so tiny, but so powerful. But one of the things that she did was that she lived in a home in Philadelphia with young people. I mean, it was sort of like a little commune in a way, kind of a group home there. And the idea that older people, in a sense, living with younger people and sort of taking care of each other. Is that a model do you think we can replicate?
I would love to see us replicate that model. There's a number of really interesting, innovative models out there for how to live well as we age. And my favorite of those models are the ones that are intergenerational in character. There's also the village movement that's growing around the country. It started in Boston with a group of friends who wanted to age together, live together as they aged, and started sharing resources. And now over 200 villages around the country where they have been able to secure discounted groceries, transportation, share caregivers, all kinds of resources to improve quality of life. And I think that intergenerational versions of those villages where we're thinking very intentionally about the caregiving needs of both children and older adults in the community, as well as a range of needs of people in the community together is really the future.
What about older people living, instead of caretakers living in older people's homes, if you reversed it, that older people lived in the caretaker homes?
So that's funny you brought that up. That's one of the ideas in the second section of my book. We call it the care pod.
That's right.
But this idea that we could have caregivers and their families actually serving as hosts to older people who could live with them for periods of time. And part of what they would be doing is contributing to a mortgage or to the long-term ability of that caregiver and their family to be able to own that apartment. So kind of like a care-to-own plan where the senior is actually helping to contribute to affordable housing options for low-income families as well. So trying to create, there's one of the reasons why I'm so hopeful is because it feels like there's so many win-win scenarios here when we think holistically about the solutions.
Well, I like to be hopeful as well, but I also know that we are in a country that denies death. We don't want to talk about it. We don't want to prepare for it. We have a lot of cockamamie ideas, I think, about what we think it is. So in part, people don't prepare because they cannot imagine. They don't want to imagine what it means to be ill or to die. And we often move older people sort of out of the way so we don't even have to see them anymore.
It's true. There are real cultural barriers. But I do believe between the boomers really being well positioned to transform the way we feel about aging in this country culturally, and the tremendous need on the part of families across generations to really face the reality of what's coming. I mean, there isn't a single person that I talk to who doesn't have a care story that's very present for them, and that includes millennials. I'll tell you what, millennials are more connected to their grandparents than any generation in history, and there are more grandparents than ever before. And I think that the multi-generational connections that come with longevity, where you actually have longer to connect and to build relationships and to love and to really be a part of young people in your family's lives, that's going to be a huge part of the solution as well.
Why do you think millennials feel so connected to their grandparents?
Well, there's new cultural research coming out about the similarities between the millennial generation and the boomer generation. First, they're about the same size in terms of numbers. And second, there are lots of kind of resonances as generations that really seek to change the world, that believe in kind of charting their own way communication in terms of tech platforms has enabled more communication. So a lot of young people say that older people have ruined Facebook.
Well, yes, I've heard that argument or complaint.
Right. But I think what it signals is that younger people and older people are using these platforms, and it's creating a new arena for connection.
Let me reintroduce you. That's Ai-Jen Poo, and she is the author of a new book called The Age of Dignity, and it's subtitled Preparing for the Elder Boom in a Changing America. Again, she's also director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance, co-director of Caring Across Generations, pulling all these ideas together about how to provide high quality and affordable care for elders, especially the boomers who are aging, also to ensure that the people providing that care are paid as professionals and treated as professionals, and also the role perhaps that millennials and grandchildren can play in this very interesting challenge that we have. Taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. In fact, we have a tweet from Joseph. He says, regarding regarding aging in place as suburban boomers age and become unable to drive? How will mostly unwalkable suburban towns adapt? Do you have an answer to that, Ai-Jen?
A lot of our towns and our cities, particularly in rural areas, are going to have to figure out how we become age-friendly geographies. Many cities have started to take this up already in thinking about how to make their transportation systems more accessible and so on. So, for example, in the state of Maine, the Speaker of the House, Speaker Eaves, has a program called the Keep Me Home Initiative, which has a number of legislative pillars that includes everything from revamping making transportation systems much more accessible to older people in suburban areas and in rural areas, to raising wages for caregivers. And so I think we are going to have to rethink a lot about the way that we live. But this is, again, the fact that we are living longer is really a blessing. I mean, it is the opportunity to love longer, to teach longer, to learn longer, to connect longer, if we have the right supports in place. And that is one of the reasons why this book is really encouraging families and our nation as a whole to think about how we prepare from a place not of crisis and emergency, but from a place of planning and intention, and even thinking about what joys and good will come from preparing.
What a novel idea. Preparing for the future.
Right.
Maybe we should all try that. We have an email from David, kind of picking up on what you just said. Will there be enough workers to care for the elderly? What impact will attempts to limit immigration have on this labor situation? Will this cause the U.S. to relax immigration restrictions? Are we talking largely about immigrants who are providing this kind of care?
We estimate that about a third of the caregiving professional workforce is immigrant. And so immigrants will be a huge part of the solution here, absolutely. And in fact, as a result, we've actually gone out and talked to a lot of seniors all over the country and states like Missouri and Ohio. And, you know, when you first talk to them about immigration, oftentimes there's a lot of hesitation because of the state of the economy and lots of other reasons. And then when you talk about it in the context of expanding and strengthening the home care workforce for the future to really support our ability to age in place, the support for immigration reform actually really does increase.
Wow.
And so I think that there is an opportunity to bring two issues that seem very separate, but as your listener points out, are actually interdependent to the forefront here. And one of the things that we're interested in doing is finding a champion in Congress who can help introduce a caregiver path to citizenship so that we can actually ensure that our immigrant caregivers in this country have the ability to come out of the shadows and through training and workforce preparation actually be able to contribute to our families and our economy as home care workers.
So you're saying that these immigrant caregivers are probably undocumented, most of them?
There's a number of them who are, absolutely. And in fact, I have a friend whose mother is cared for by an undocumented caregiver in Staten Island, and she has Alzheimer's. And she cannot imagine not being supported. And their entire family really relies on this woman who is undocumented. And every day on her way to work, she risks being deported as a result of her status. And it would not only set the woman, my friend's mother, back in terms of her managing her illness, but in terms of the entire family, they can't imagine what they would do if she were suddenly disappeared. And so we're already depending on an undocumented caregiving workforce, and it's time to really bring them out of the shadows and make them the part of the solution that they are.
Do you see this? I mean, do you see an interest in Congress to address this issue from this angle, looking at the kind of dependence that families have on these immigrants for care, and using that as a way of addressing immigration reform?
I think the awareness is increasing on that front. And, you know, anything In Congress right now seems like an uphill battle.
Yes.
So, you know, we are not necessarily going to be naive about that, but I definitely think that this poses an opening, and if the American people see it, which increasingly they do, and the more of us demand it of our elected officials, I think the more it will become a real possibility.
Your book is full of stories, the stories really about relationships, and in many ways, really loving, intimate relationships. By telling stories and sort of humanizing this issue, is that a way that you're wanting to, in a sense, sound the alarm?
Yes. Well, one thing that I've noticed is that this caregiving is such a huge part of everyone's, of our human experience across race, class, geography, generation. Everyone has a care story. Everyone has someone in their life who's cared for them and finds that relationship absolutely invaluable. And yet it is so rarely a part of our public conversation about our priorities as a nation, about politics, about where we want this country to go. And that is the leap that this storytelling effort is trying to make. It's trying to make visible what an important part of our human experience in this country caregiving really is, and how important it is for the future that we actually prioritize support for caregiving in a totally different way.
Let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Ai-Jen Poo, author of a new book called The Age of Dignity, Preparing for the Elder Boom in a Changing America, also director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance, co-director of Caring Across Generations, and was awarded a MacArthur Genius Fellowship last year in 2014. We'll take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Looks like a bunch of people want to join us as well. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Do stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain. Does the country, do families have a support system in place to provide care for elders? And are these well-paid jobs with good benefits? The answer, at least today, is probably no and no. And our guest, Ai-Jen Poo, director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance, is also the author of a new book called The Age of Dignity, about how to make life better for home care workers while improving quality of life for seniors, most of whom want to age in place, age in their homes. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Are other countries, before we get to our callers, Ai-Jen, I was wondering whether other countries are models that we can look at, because countries around the world are dealing with an aging population, an aging boomer population.
Yes, a number of countries have been ahead of us in terms of the aging demographic changes. Japan and Germany are two examples that I talk about in the book, both of whom have universal long-term care programs connected to their healthcare programs. And they've struggled and shifted those programs, improved them over the years, but have been able to provide a level of care to their aging population that has actually created efficiency in the healthcare system for them. And so I do think that there's an important lesson there, in that in some ways the best prevention is good caregiving, and much of what people need to live well is exactly what they need for good health care. And so the more we can think about how we create a caregiving infrastructure that is connected to and integrated with our healthcare system, I think the more beneficial it will be to families who are really focused on quality of life as opposed to delay of death. And Japan has a really interesting system that I write about as well. It's called the Caring Relationship Tickets. And what it is essentially a time banking system where you could go to your neighbor's house and provide a couple hours of care or support to your older neighbor and bank that time and those services so that your mother on the other side of the country could receive 2 hours of care from her neighbor, or you could someday cash in that time and those services. And increasingly, cities in the United States are also experimenting with time banking ideas. But that program has been very successful in Japan.
Do you see any evidence of this in the Affordable Care Act as it's currently written?
No, the Affordable Care Act does a lot of things, but it does not address the long-term care needs that are non-medical in nature, that are about supporting the activities of daily living. Many activities like what my grandmother needs in terms of support with cooking, cleaning, lifting, things that become harder as you become more frail, administering medication, managing chronic illnesses, making sure that people are bathed and eating healthy for their particular health needs. These are things that are not necessarily very medical in nature, but are about supporting a good quality of life and safety and security, as well as a dimension that is about human relationship and caring.
Let me see what Julie from Newtown has to say. Julie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
One of the things that I've been hearing and have experienced myself with both parents is that it seems that the caregivers from these different agencies don't have much training. And, my hairdresser has to go through all kinds of hoops and get a special license just to cut my hair. Mm-hmm. But it seems that these caregivers don't get anything. It's very frustrating, especially when I wanted one to take care of my mother, to go in the shower and make sure my mother was clean. And she refused to go in. That's what we paid her for.
Mm-hmm. Well, Julie, let me see what our guest has to say in response to your question and your concern. Go ahead, Ai-Jen.
Julie makes a really good point here. It is true that there's actually no training standard for personal care aides or home care workers or home attendants. And so that is one of the things that we're working on, is really ensuring, it really reflects a lack of recognition that this is a professional workforce and a lack of investment in the skill it takes to do this work. And so we think absolutely that training, providing real person-driven training, is a big part of the solution for the future, so that our workforce is not only strong, but prepared.
And it does require a certain kind of person. Not everyone can provide the kind of care that you're describing to an older person. Sometimes that older person is difficult, or they're dealing with their own losses and things and aren't always in the greatest of spirits.
That's right. It's a challenging profession. It's also incredibly rewarding. And it's the kind of profession where the right match is very important. Sometimes you need to find the right person who has the right disposition and experience or commitment to the particular situation that your family or your loved one is facing. And so a lot of it is also about finding the right match.
Let me see what John from Cherry Hill has to say. John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to say that, talking about the wages and the low wages of these care workers, there's an awful lot behind these folks supporting them. You might have a registered nurse that's overseeing the case, who's directing everything. The worker may be a low-skilled worker. I think you've been talking a lot about that. They may be LPNs. They may be registered nurses. There may be round-the-clock care. There's liability. There's audits behind the system, sometimes as many as one a month for these agents. These companies that are providing the care, there's just an awful lot
sure.
there. And And I really think that as far as hearing the previous caller talking about the training and the competency, again, much of the care is provided by LPNs and registered nurses. So a lot of it is, you know, well-trained people doing a good job. And the last comment I'll make is I think that there is no cheaper, less expensive care delivery system in the country. You're seeing a lot of hospitals and all doing everything possible to keep people home, and this is a very cost-efficient, relatively cost-efficient way to do things. Unless we're willing, as a country, society, to reduce that liability, I don't think the costs are going to go down. You know, for home health care.
Well, John, I appreciate your calls and your comments to Radio Times. Let me see what our guest, Ajahn Poo, has to say. Go ahead.
I also appreciate those comments. I think that it's a question of what is, in my book, I call it the care grid. I call it the grid because I do think that there is an infrastructure and systems challenge here. When we think about the 27 million Americans who are going to need some form of care or assistance just to meet their basic daily needs, on top of the fact that the entire long-term care system is still biased towards nursing home care, while 90% of us want to actually age in place at home in our communities, the kind of patchwork system we have in place is simply not sufficient. And so I do think that there will be cost associated up front with putting some new systems and infrastructure in place, including training for personal care aides and home care workers who are really on the front lines of the day-to-day, day-in and day-out needs of millions of seniors. And I think that that investment on the front end in strengthening that workforce, providing training, actually not only for the professional caregivers, but also for family caregivers who are also on the front lines of this, supporting family caregivers as well, that if we can put that kind of care infrastructure in place, that in the long run, it will save our entire system a lot of money in helping us do everything from having a better quality of life for our seniors for longer, as well as better managing chronic illnesses, avoiding unnecessary emergency room visits, all kinds of things that a trained, prepared, and strong caregiving workforce can help us do, as well as and in partnership with families.
John, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We have a tweet from Dorothy. She says the program has discussed age and gender economy, but not the role of racism in low wages and disrespect for domestic workers. Do you see it that way?
You know, what's really important about what that listener raises is that race has historically played a huge role in shaping working conditions and invisibility in this workforce. And it dates back to the 1930s when the New Deal was put into place. Southern members of Congress refused to support the New Deal labor protections, the foundation of our nation's labor laws, if domestic workers and farm workers were included. And so in a concession to members of Congress who did not want largely African-American workers to be protected, the bills were passed with those exclusions in place, and they remain to this day. And to this day, many home care workers and domestic workers are women of color. Many are still African American and also immigrant women of color and still face these unjust exclusions that are part of this legacy. So race has absolutely factored in here. And part of a racial equity agenda for the future has to be uplifting this workforce.
Thanks for the tweet from Dorothy. There are also families that are not relying on domestic workers and are doing this work themselves and and probably caring for family members and raising children. That's the sandwich generation. I don't know if you're part of it or not, but sort of adding to the kind of stresses and the sense of responsibility to take care of one's parents or one's elders in a way that gives them some kind of respect and security.
Yes. We call it the panini effect because there's such a squeeze happening on this generation that's just struggling without any support to afford child care and elder care. Both generations having tremendous needs at this point. And we think that the sandwich generation is going to be critical mm-hmm. in helping us find the right solutions. This generation is responsible for managing a lion's share of the care that is happening in this country, and they're doing so without adequate supports, without financial supports, but really supports in terms of navigating the labyrinth of applications and paperwork and options or lack thereof. And so I think that we absolutely need to pay attention to the mm-hmm. needs of family caregivers, hear their stories, and make sure that they are a big part of the solution.
I mean, it seems we have this, you're kind of on your own mentality in this country. You know, you have children and you're sort of on your own to raise them and to try to find money to afford good child care for them. And then it's happening at the other end as well.
Yeah, it's a funny thing that
it
now
is.
With more than half of the paid workforce women, and you know, women as you know, more than half of all college graduates, more than half of the electorate, it is actually no longer viable to assume that there will be somebody who can actually, and given our economic reality, of course, fundamentally, it's no longer viable to assume that there will be one person who's able to stay home to provide family care work. And so we need a new kind of support that's reflective of our 21st century reality. And that simply has not emerged. Our laws and policies reflect another era, another different kind of family structure, different economy, another era. And so we need to really update those systems.
I want to squeeze one more caller in, William from Howell. William, we're almost out of time, but go ahead. You can ask your question.
Okay, I'll go very quickly. My name is William. I'm from Howell, New Jersey. I am a retired bureaucrat, I guess you would say.
Well, you know, William, I need you to ask the question. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. My question is to your guest, what about consumer-directed care and the cash and counseling model? I haven't heard this mentioned today as a method for achieving good outcomes for long-term care for people at home.
Okay, fair enough. Ajahn Poo, are you aware of that, consumer-directed services?
Absolutely, and I think it's a very important option. We probably don't have time to get really into it, but I absolutely think that that is a lot of what's been figured out through consumer-directed models. It points the way to the future in terms of what we need to be really investing in.
So you are optimistic, or perhaps I should put it in 30 seconds or less, why are you so optimistic?
Because care is the future. Care connects us all. And through working on care solutions that support us all, I think we can all be stronger.
Well, I appreciate you joining us today in Radio Times, giving us something to think about and to be optimistic about as well. Ajahn Poo, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. The book is called The Age of Dignity, Preparing for the Elder Boom in a Changing America. And again, she is director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance, a co-director of Caring Across Generations, and won a MacArthur Fellowship last year. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show, how to find us on Facebook, how to follow us on Twitter, how to sign up for the Radio Times newsletter, and also how to find us on satellite radio. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens with Quinn Libsen. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.